drew back from him, I straightened my back and looked down at the fool in my arms. For an instant he gazed clear-eyed at me with only wonder in his face. Then the pain of his racked body demanded his attention. I saw him clench his eyes to it and wince away from my touch. "I'm sorry," I said softly. I eased him down onto the cloak. The evergreen boughs that had been his funeral pyre were his mattress now. "You did not have the reserves for me to perform a complete healing, perhaps in a day or two." But he already slept. I lifted a corner of the cloak and draped it over his eyes to shield them from the rising sun. I sniffed the air, and it came to me that it would be a good time to hunt. I took the whole morning for the hunt, and came back with a brace of rabbits and some greens. The fool still lay as I had left him. I cleaned the rabbits and hung the meat to bleed. I set up his tent in the shade. I found the elderling robe he had once given to me, and laid it out inside the tent. I checked on the fool. He slept on. I studied him critically. Biting insects had found him. They and the growing strength of the sun on his skin convinced me that I should move him. "Beloved," I said quietly. He made no response. I spoke to him anyway, knowing that sometimes we are aware of the things we hear when we are sleeping. "I'm going to move you. It may hurt." He made no response. I worked my arms under the cloak and lifted him as gently as I could. Still he cried out wordlessly, squirming in my arms as he tried to escape the pain. His eyes opened as I carried him across the ancient plaza to the tent in the shade of the trees. He looked at me and through me, not knowing me, not truly awake.
"Please," he begged me brokenly, "please stop. Don't hurt me any more. Please."
"You're safe now," I comforted him. "It's over. It's all done."
"Please,"
he cried out again loudly. I had to drop to one knee to get him inside the tent. He shrieked as the fabric brushed over his raw back in passing. I set him down as gently as I could. "You'll be out of the sun and away from the insects here," I told him. I don't think he heard me.
"Please, no more. Whatever you want, anything, just stop. Stop."
"It has stopped," I told him. "You're safe now."
"Please."
His eyes fluttered closed again. He was still. He had never truly wakened. I went out of the tent. I had to be away from him. I was sick at heart for him, and wretched with my own sudden memories. I had known torture. Regal's methods had been crude, but effective. But I had had a small shield that the fool had lacked. I had known that as long as I held out against him, as long as I could refuse to give him proof that I was witted, he could not simply kill me. So I had held firm against the beatings and deprivations. I had not given Regal what he wanted. Giving him that would have allowed him to kill me, without compunction, with the sanction of the dukes of the six duchies. And in the end, when I knew that I could not hold out any longer, I had snatched my death from him, taking poison, rather than allowing him to break me. But for the fool there had been nothing he could hold back. He had nothing that the pale woman wanted, except his pain. What had she made him beg for? What had she made him promise, only to laugh at his capitulation and begin again on his tormented flesh? I didn't want to know. I didn't want to know, and it shamed me that I fled his pain. By refusing to acknowledge what he had suffered, could I pretend it had not happened? Little tasks are how I have always hidden from my thoughts. I refilled my water skin with clean, cold water from the creek. I stole fuel from the former funeral pyre and built a small cook fire from it. When it was burning well, I set one rabbit to roast on a skewer and the other to bubbling in a pot. I gathered up my strewn winter garments, beat some of the dirt from them, and hung them on bushes to air. In the course of my tasks I found the rooster crown, where the fool had apparently flung it in a peak. I brought it back and set it just inside the flap of the tent. I went to the stream and scrubbed myself clean with horsetails, and then bound my dripping hair back in a warrior's tail. I did not feel like a warrior. I wondered if I would have felt better if I'd killed her. I thought of going back and killing the pale woman and bringing her head to the fool. I did not think it would help. Or, quite likely, I would have done it. I set the rabbit soup aside to cool and ate the roasted one. Nothing quite compares to fresh meat when one has gone a long time without it. It was bloody near the bone and succulent. I ate like a wolf, immersing myself in the moment, and in the sensation of feeding. But eventually I had to toss the last gnawed bone into the fire and contemplate the evening ahead of me. I took the kettle of soup into the tent. The fool was awake. He lay on his belly and stared at the corner of the tent. The long light of late afternoon shone through the tent's panels and dappled him with colour. I had known he was awake. The renewal of our skill bond made it impossible for me not to know. I could block most of the physical pain he felt. It was harder to block his anguish. "I brought you food," I said to him. After some silence had passed, I told him, "Beloved, you need to eat and drink. I've brought fresh water." I waited. "I could make tea for you if you like." Eventually, I fetched a mug and poured the cooling broth into it. "Just drink this, and I'll stop bothering you, but only if you drink this." Crickets were chirping in the dusk. "Beloved, I mean it. I won't leave you in peace until you at least drink this." He spoke. His voice was flat, and he did not look at me. "Could you not call me that?" "Beloved?" I asked, confused. He winced to the word. "Yes, that." I sat holding the mug of cold broth in both hands. After a time I said stiffly, "If that is what you wish, fool, but I'm still not leaving until you drink this." He moved in the dimness of the tent, turning his head toward me and then reaching a hand for the mug. "She mocked me with that name," he said quietly. "Oh." He took the mug awkwardly from me, protecting his torn fingertips from contact. He levered himself up on an elbow, quivering with pain and effort. I wanted to help him, I knew better than to offer. He drank the broth in two long draughts, and then held the mug out to me shakily. I took it, and he sank down on his belly again. When I continued to sit there, he pointed out wearily, "I drank it." I took the kettle and the mug out into the night with me. I added more water to the kettle of soup and set it near the fire. Let it simmer until morning. I sat staring into the fire, recalling things I didn't want to think about and chewing on my thumbnail until I bit it too close to the quick and tore it. I grimaced, and then, staring out into the night, shook my head. I had been unable to retreat into being a wolf. As a wolf, I had not been humiliated and degraded. As a wolf, I'd kept my dignity and power over my life. The fool had nowhere to go. I'd had Burek and his calm, familiar ways. I'd had isolation and peace and the wolf. I thought of Night Eyes and rose and went to the hunt. My first night's luck did not hold. I came back to the camp after sunrise with no meat, but a shirt full of ripe plums. The fool was gone. A kettle of tea had been left to stay warm by the fire. I resisted the urge to call out his name and waited, almost patiently, by the fire until I saw him coming up the path from the stream. He wore the elderling robe, and his hair was slicked flat to his skull with water. He walked without grace, in a lurching limp, and his shoulders were bowed. With difficulty I restrained myself from going to him. He reached the fire at last, and, "I found plums," I told him. He took one solemnly and bit into it. "They're sweet," he said, as if it surprised him. With an old man's caution he lowered himself to the ground. I saw him run his tongue around the inside of his mouth and winced with him when he found the gap of missing teeth on one side. "Tell me what happened," he requested quietly. So I did. I began with her guards throwing me out into the snow, and reported in as much detail as if it were Chade sitting there, nodding to my words. His face changed slowly as I began to speak about the dragons. Slowly he sat up straighter. I felt the skill link between us intensify as he reached for my heart to confirm what he was hearing, as if mere words could not be enough to convey it to him. Willingly I opened myself to him and let him share my experience of that day. When I told him that Icefire and Tintaglia had mated in flight and then disappeared, a sob shook him. But he was tearless as he asked me incredulously, "Then we triumphed. She failed. There will be dragons in the skies of this world again." "Of course," I said, and only then realized that he could not have known that. "We walk in your future now, on the path you set for us." He choked again, audibly. He rose stiffly and paced a turn or two. He turned back to me, his heart in his eyes.
But I am blind here. I never foresaw any of this, always in every vision. If there was triumph, I bought it with my death. I always died.
He cocked his head slowly and asked me, as if for confirmation.
I did die.
You did, I admitted slowly. But I could not help the grin that crept over my face. But, as I told you in Buckkeep, I am the catalyst, I am the changer. He stood still as stone, and when comprehension seeped into him, it was like watching a stone dragon come to wakefulness. Life infused him, he began to tremble, and this time I did not fear to take his arm and help him sit down.
The rest, he demanded shakily. Tell me the rest.
And so I told him. The rest of that day as we ate plums and drank his tea, and then finished the rabbit broth from the night before. I told him what I knew of the black man, and his eyes grew wide. I spoke of searching for his body, and reluctantly told how I had found him. He looked aside from me as I spoke, and I felt our skill link fade, as if he would vanish from my sight if he could. Nonetheless, I told him, and told him, too, of my encounter with the pale woman. He sat rubbing his arms while I spoke of her, and when he asked,
"Then she lives still. She did not die."
His voice shook. "I did not kill her," I admitted, and—
"Why?"
he demanded shrilly, incredulously.
"But why didn't you kill her, Fitz? Why?"
That outburst shocked me, and I felt stupid and defensive as I said, "I don't know, perhaps because I thought she wanted me to." The words seemed foolish to me, but I said them anyway. First the black man, and then the pale woman said I was the catalyst for this time, the changer. I did not want to cause any change to what you had done. For a time, silence held between us. He rocked back and forth, very slightly, breathing through his mouth. After a time he seemed to calm, or perhaps he only deadened. Then, with an effort he tried to conceal, he said,
"I'm sure you did what was best, Fitz. I don't hold it against you."
Perhaps he meant those words, but I think it was hard for either of us to believe them just then. It dimmed the glow of his triumph and made a small shadowy wall between us. Nevertheless, I continued my account, and when I spoke of how we had come here through a skill pillar I'd found in the Ice Palace, he grew very still.
"I never saw that," he admitted with a shade of wonder. "Never even guessed it."
The rest was quickly told. When I came to the Rooster Crown and my shock that it was not some powerful magical talisman, but only five poets frozen in time, he lifted one shoulder as if to excuse his desiring such a frivolous item. "It wasn't for me that I wanted it," he said quietly. I sat silent for a moment, waiting for him to enlarge on that. When he did not, I let it go. Even when my tale was done and he realized how completely he had won, he seemed oddly muted. His triumph might have been years ago instead of mere days. The way he accepted it made it seem inevitable instead of a battle hard won. Evening had crept up on us. He made no effort to tell me of what had befallen him. I did not expect him to. Yet the quiet that followed and fell between us was like a telling. It spoke of humiliation, and the bafflement that something done to him could make him feel shamed. I understood it too well. I understood, too, that if I had tried to tell him that, I would have sounded condescending. Our silences lasted too long. The small sentences, my telling him that I would fetch more firewood, or his observation that the cheering of the insects was actually pleasant after our silent nights on the glacier, seemed to float like isolated bubbles on the quiet that separated us. At last he said that he was going to bed. He entered the tent, and I did the small tasks one does around a camp at night. I banked the fire so that the coals would survive until the morning and tidied away our clutter. It was only when I approached the tent that I found my cloak outside it, neatly folded on the ground. I took it and made my own bed near the fire. I understood that he still struggled and that he wished to be alone. Yet still it stung, mostly because I wanted him to be more healed than he was. Night was deep, and I was sleeping soundly when the first shriek burst from the tent. I sat up, my heart pounding and my hand going immediately to the sword on the ground beside me. Before I could draw it from the sheath, the fool burst from the tent, eyes wide and hair wild. The panic of his breathing shook his entire body, and his mouth hung wide in his effort to gulp down air. "What is it?" I demanded, and he started again, flinching back from me. Then he appeared to come to himself and to recognize my shadow by the banked fire.
"It's nothing. It was a bad dream."
And then he clutched his elbows and bent over his crossed arms, rocking slightly, as if some terrible pain gnawed at his vitals. After a moment he admitted, "I dreamed she came through the pillar. I woke up and thought I saw her standing over me in the tent. I don't think she knows what a skill pillar is, or how it works," I offered him. Then I heard how uncertain a reassurance that was, and wished I had said nothing. He did not reply. Instead, he came shivering through the mild night to stand close to the fire. Without asking him, I leaned over and put more wood on it. He stood, hugging himself and watching as the flames woke and took hold of the fuel. Then he said apologetically,
"I can't go back in there tonight. I can't."
I didn't say anything, but spread my cloak wider on the ground. Cautious as a cat, he approached it. He did not speak as he lowered himself awkwardly to the ground and stretched out between me and the fire. I lay still, waiting for him to relax. The fire mumbled to itself, and despite myself, my eyes grew heavy again. I was just starting the slide toward sleep when he spoke quietly. "Do you ever get over it? Did you ever get past it?" He asked me so earnestly for there to be a tomorrow that did not possess that shadow. I told the hardest truth I have ever had to utter. "No, you don't. I didn't. You won't. But you do go on. It becomes a part of you, like any scar. You will go on." That night, as we slept back to back beneath the stars on my old cloak, I felt him shudder, and then twitch and fight in his sleep. I rolled to face him. Tears slid gleaming down his cheeks, and he struggled wildly, promising the night,
"Please stop! Stop! Anything! Anything! Only please, please stop!"
I touched him, and he gave a wild shriek and fought me savagely for an instant. Then he came awake, gasping. I released him, and he immediately rolled free of me. On hands and knees, he scuttled away from me, over the stone of the plaza to the forest edge, where he hung his head like a sick dog and retched over and over, trying to choke up the cowardly words he had said. I did not go to him. Not then. When he came back, walking, I offered him my water skin. He rinsed his mouth, spat, and then drank. He stood, looking away from me, staring into the night as if he could find the lost pieces of himself there. I waited. Eventually, silently, he came back and sank down onto the cloak beside me. When he finally lay down, he lay on his side, huddled in a ball, facing away from me. Shudders ran over him. I sighed. I stretched out beside him. I edged closer to him, and despite his resistance, carefully turned him to face me, and took him into my awkward embrace. He was weeping silently, and I thumbed the tears from his cheeks. Mindful of his raw back, I drew him close, tucked his head under my chin, and wrapped my arms around him. I kissed the top of his head gently. "Go to sleep, fool," I told him gruffly. "I'm here. I'll take care of you." His hands came up between us, and I feared he would push me away. Instead, he clutched the front of my shirt and clung tightly to me. All that night I cradled him in my arms as closely as if he were my child, or my lover, as closely as if he were myself, wounded and alone. I held him while he wept, and I held him after his weeping was done. I let him take whatever comfort he could in the warmth and strength of my body. I have never felt less of a man that I did so. Chapter 30. Whole. I write this in my own pen, and plead that you excuse the mountain hand with which I ink the Six Duchies characters. A formal writ is being prepared by our esteemed scribe, Phedron. But in this scroll I desired to write to you myself, widow to widow, and woman to woman, so that you may know well that I understand that no grant of land or title can make any easier the loss that you have suffered. Your husband spent most of his life in service to the Farseer Rain. Truly, he should have been rewarded years ago for all he did for his kings. His was a song which should have been sung in every hall. It was only by his risking of his life that I survived that dark night when Regal the Pretender turned upon us. In his modesty, he begged that his deeds remain unsung. It seems a callous thing that only now, when he has suffered death in our service, does the Six Duchies' throne recall all that we owe to him. I was seeking to select crown lands that would amply reward Burric's service, when a courier arrived from Lady Patience. Truly, ill news seems to fly swiftly, for she had already been informed of your husband's passing. She wrote to me that he was among the most cherished of friends to the late Prince Chivalry, and that she was certain her lord would have wished to see his estate at Withywoods pass into your family's stewardship. Title to these lands shall be immediately conveyed to you, to remain with your family forever. Letter from Queen Catricken to Molly Chandler Burrickswift.
I dreamed I was you, he spoke softly to the flames of the fire.
Did you?
And you were me.
How droll.
Don't do that, he warned me. Don't do what? I asked him innocently. Don't be me.
He shifted in the bedding beside me. Night was a canopy over us, and the wind was warm. He lifted thin fingers to push the golden hair back from his face. The dying light of the fire could almost conceal the bruises fading from his face, but his cheekbones were still too prominent. I wanted to tell him that someone had to be him, as he himself had stopped doing it so completely. Instead, I asked him, why not?
It unnerves me.
He took a deep breath and sighed it out.
How long have we been here?
It was the third time he'd awakened me that night. I'd grown accustomed to it. He did not sleep well at night. I didn't expect him to. I recalled clearly how I had chosen to sleep only by day, and when Burric was near me, watching over me, in the days of my recovery from Regal's dungeons. There are times when it is comforting to sleep with sunlight on your eyelids, and times when quiet talk at night is better than sleep, no matter how weary you are. I tried to think how much time had passed since I'd carried his body through the pillar. It was strangely difficult. The interrupted nights and the sun-dappled days of rest seemed to multiply themselves. 5 days, if we count days, 4 nights, if we count nights. Don't fret about it, you're still very weak. I don't want to try the skill pillar until you are stronger.
I don't want to try the skill pillar at all.
I made a sound of agreement. But eventually we have to. I cannot leave Thick with the black man forever. And I told Chade that we would be on the beach ready to greet the ship when it arrived. That should be in about 5 days, I think. I had lost track of time in the ice labyrinth. I tried to be concerned about it. I had blocked all skill contact with the coterie since our failed healing attempt. Several times I had felt vague scratching at my door, but I'd determinedly ignored them. They were probably concerned for me. I said aloud to convince myself, I have a life to get back to.
I don't.
The fool sounded rather satisfied about that. That encouraged me. There were still moments in the day when he halted, motionless, as if listening for futures that no longer beckoned to him. I wondered what it was like for him. For his entire life he'd endeavoured to set the track of time into the path that he perceived as best. And he had achieved that. We lived in the future that he had devised. I think he alternated between satisfaction with the future he had created and anxiety about his role in it, when he gave thought to such things. Sometimes he simply sat, his damaged hands cradled in his lap, as he looked at the soil just beyond his knees. His eyes were afar then, his breathing so slow and shallow that his chest scarce moved with it. I knew that when he sat so, he was trying to make sense of things. that were inherently senseless. I did not try to talk him out of it, but I did try, as now, to be optimistic about the days to come. That's right, you don't have a life that you must return to. No burden to take up, no harness to resume. You died. See how pleasant it can be to have died. Once you've died, no one expects you to be a king or a prophet. He propped himself up on one elbow.
You speak from experience.
He spoke pensively, ignoring my jesting tone. I grinned. I do. He eased himself back onto my cloak beside me and stared up at the sky. He had not smiled. I followed his gaze. The stars were fading. I rolled away from him and came lightly to my feet. Time to hunt soon. Dawn is coming. Do you feel strong enough to come with me? I had to wait for his answer. Then he shook his head.
In all honesty, no. I'm more tired than I've ever been in my life. What did you do to my body? I've never felt this weak and battered.
You've never been tortured to death before. That did not seem a good answer to give him, so I stepped aside from it.
I think it will take you time to recover, that's all. If you had a bit more flesh on your bones, we could use the skill to heal you.
No, he flatly forbade it. I let it go by. In any case, I'm tired of Out-Islander travel rations, and we haven't much left of them anyway. Some fresh meat would do you good, which I shan't get for you by lazing here. If you want it cooked, try to wake the fire before I get back.
Very well,
he agreed quietly. I hunted poorly that dawn. Concern for the fool clouded my thoughts. I nearly stepped on one rabbit, and it still managed to elude my frantic spring. Luckily, there were fish in the stream, fat and silver and easy to tickle. I came back in the early light, wet to the shoulders, with four of them. We ate them as the sun grew strong, and then I insisted we walk together to the stream to wash the smoky grease from our hands and faces. Belly full, I was ready to sleep after that, but the fool was pensive. He sat by the fire and poked at it. The third time that he sighed, I rolled over onto my back and asked him,
"What?" "I can't go back."
"Well, you can't stay here. It's a pleasant enough place now, but take my word for it, winter here is hard."
"And you speak from experience."
I smiled. "I was a couple of valleys away from here, but yes, again, experience." He admitted,
"For the first time in my life, I don't know what to do. You have carried me forward to a place in time that is past my death. Every day when I awaken, I am shocked. I have no idea what will happen to me next. I don't know what I should be doing with my life. I feel like a boat cut loose and left to drift."
"Is that so terrible? Drift for a time, rest and grow strong. Most of us long for a place in our lives to do that." He sighed again.
"I don't know how. I've never felt like this before. I can't decide if it's bad or good. I've no idea what to do with this extra life you've given me."
"Well, you could probably stay here for the rest of the summer, if you learn to fish for yourself and hunt a bit. But you cannot hide forever from your life and friends. Eventually you must face it again." He almost smiled.
"This from the man who spent over a decade being dead. Perhaps I should follow your example. Find a quiet cottage and live like a hermit for a decade or two, then come back as someone else."
I chuckled. "Then in a decade I could come ferret you out. Of course I'll be an old man by then."
"And I shall not,"
he pointed out quietly. He met my eyes as he said it, and his face was solemn. It was an unsettling thought, and I was just as glad to leave it. I did not want to think too deeply on such things. There would be enough difficult things for me to face when I went back. Burrick's death, Swift, Nettle, Hap, eventually Molly, Burrick's widow, her now fatherless little boys. Complications I didn't want and had no idea how to deal with. It was far easier not to think about them. I pushed them aside and probably succeeded better than the fool at walling myself off from the world that awaited my return, for I was practiced at it. For the next 2 days we lived as wolves, in the now. We had meat and water, and the weather continued fair. Rabbits were plentiful, and we still had dry travel bread in my pack, so we ate well enough. The fool continued to heal, and though he did not laugh, there were times when he seemed almost relaxed. I was accustomed to his need for privacy, but now there was a dullness to his avoidance of me that saddened me. My efforts at banter woke no like response from him. He did not scowl or ignore them. He had always been so quick to find humour in even the most dismal circumstances that I felt that even in his presence I missed him. Even so, he grew stronger and moved with less caution. I told myself that he was getting better and that there was nothing more to desire. Even so, I began to feel restless, and when he said one morning, "I am strong enough now," I did not argue with him. There was little enough to prepare for us to leave. I tried to take down his elderling tent, but he shook his head, almost wildly, and then said hoarsely, "No, leave it, leave it." That surprised me. True, he had not slept in it since the nightmare, preferring to sleep between me and the fire, but I had thought he would want it. Nonetheless, I did not argue with him. In fact, as I gave it a last glance and saw how the dragons and serpents on the fine fabric rippled in the light breeze, I found I could think only of his peeled skin on the ice. I shuddered and turned away from it. In passing, I picked up the rooster crown. It had returned to its wooden state, if indeed it had ever been otherwise, save in my imagination. The silvery grey feathers stood up in their stiff row around the circlet. It still seemed to whisper and buzz in my hand. I held it out to him and asked, "What of this? A circle of jesters. Do you want it still? Shall we leave it on top of the pillar, to remember she who once wore it?" He gave me an odd look, and then said softly, "I told you, I did not want it for myself. It was for a bargain I struck long ago." He looked at me very carefully and nodded very slightly as he said, "And I think it is time that I honoured it." And so we did not go straight to the pillar, but walked again down that fading path under the overarching trees, past the creek and back to the stone garden. It was as long a hike as I recalled, and little stinging midges found us once we had entered the shade. The fool made no comment at them, but only pressed on. Birds flitted overhead, moving shadows that crossed our path. The forest teemed with life. I recalled my wonder for the first time I had glimpsed the stone dragons hidden in their sleep under the trees. I had been terrified, literally awe-stricken by them. Even though I had walked amongst them several times since then, and even seen them called to life and flight to battle the red ships for us, I still found them no less astounding. I quested ahead of us with my wit sense, and found them, dark green pools of waiting life beneath the shadowing trees. This was the resting place of all the carved dragons who had awakened to defend the six duchies from the red ships. Here we had found them, here we had wakened them with blood, wit, and skill, and here they had returned when the year of battle was over. Dragons, I had called them, and called them still, from long habit, but not all of them took that shape. Some spoke of other fancies, or of heraldic beasts of legend. Vines draped the immense figures of carved stone, and the winged boar had a cap of last year's leaves on his head. They were stone to the eye, and alive to my wit-touch, gleaming with colour and detail. I could sense the life that teemed deep within the stone, but could not rouse it. I walked among them with more knowledge now than when I had first discovered them here, and even fancied I could tell which ones had been worked by elderling hands, and which were the work of six duchies' skill coteries. The winged buck was a six duchies' dragon, and no mistake. Those that were more dragon-like in form now, I suspected, were the elderling's work. I went first, of course, to Verity as dragon. I did not torment myself with trying to rouse him from whatever stone dream held him. I did take off my shirt and dust the forest debris from his scaled brow and muscled back and folded wings. Buck blue he gleamed in the dappling sunlight after I had polished the length of him who had been my king. After all I had endured lately, the sleeping creature looked peaceful to me now. I hoped he truly was. The fool had gone, of course, to girl on a dragon. As I approached them, I saw that he stood quietly before her, the crown in one hand. The other hand rested lightly on the dragon's shoulder, and I noted that his skilled fingers touched the creature. His face was very still as he looked up at the figure of the girl astride the dragon. She was breathtakingly lovely. Her hair was more golden than the fool's. It fell to her shoulders and caressed them with its loose curls. Her skin was like cream. She wore a jerkin of hunter green, but her legs and feet were bare. Her dragon was even more glorious, his scales the shining green of dark emeralds. He possessed the lax grace of a sleeping hunting cat. When last I had seen her, she had been posed in sleep upon the dragon, her rounded arms wrapped around his lithe neck. Now she sat upright on her mount. Her eyes were closed, but she lifted her face as if she could feel the errant sunbeams that touched her cheek. A very faint smile curved her lips. Crushed green plants beneath her sleeping steed indicated how recently she had flown. She had carried the fool to Asleveal Island and then returned here to rejoin her fellows in sleep. I thought I had walked quietly, but as I approached, the fool turned his head and looked at me. "Do you recall how we attempted to free her? That night?" I bowed my head. I felt a bit ashamed still that I had ever been so young and rash. I've repented it ever since. I had touched her with the skill, thinking it might be enough to free her. Instead, it had only roused her to her torment. He nodded slowly. "But what about the second time you touched her? Do you remember that?" I sighed heavily. It had been the night I had skill-walked and seen Molly take Burrick as her man. Later that evening I had worn Verity's body, for he had borrowed mine to get himself a son. To get dutiful upon Queen Catrican. I had not known that had been his intent. In an old man's aching body I had wandered the memory stone quarry, wandered it until Night Eyes and I had come upon the fool at his forbidden task. He had been chipping at the stone around the dragon's feet, trying to finish the dragon so it might be set free. I had felt sorry for him. So great was his empathy with the creature. I had known, too, what it truly took to quicken a dragon, not just the work of a man's hands, but the surrender of his life and his memory, his loves and his pains and his joys, and so I had set Verity's skill-silvered hands to the rocky flesh of girl on a dragon, and I had poured forth into her all the misery and pain of my short life, that she might take it and take life with it. Into the dragon I had poured my parents' abandonment of me to the care of strangers, and all I had suffered at Galen's hands, and in Regal's dungeon. I had given those memories to the dragon to keep and to hold and to shape herself with. I had given her my loneliness as a child and every sharp-edged misery of that night, given it willingly, and felt my pain ease even as the world dulled around me and my love of it dimmed slightly. I would have given far more if the wolf had not stopped me. Night Eyes had rebuked me, saying that he had no wish to be bonded to a forged one. I had not at that time grasped what he meant. Having seen the warriors who served the pale woman, I thought I understood better now. I thought I understood, too, what the fool had in mind and why he had come here. "Don't do it," I pleaded with him. And when he looked at me in sharp surprise, I said, "I know you were thinking of putting your memories of her torture of you into the dragon. Girl on a dragon could drain them out of you and keep them forever locked away where they cannot stab you. It would work. I know that. But there is a cost to that surcease from pain, fool. When you dull pain and hide it from yourself..." My words trickled away. I did not want to sound self-pitying. "You dull your joys as well." He said it simply. He looked away from me for a time, his lips folded. I wondered if he weighed the one against the other. Would he decide to be rid of night terrors at the expense of taking fresh joy in every morning? "I saw that in you afterwards," he said. "I felt guilty. If I had not been chipping away at girl on a dragon, you never would have done it. I wished to undo it. Years later, when I came to see you at your cottage, I thought... surely he will be healed by now. Surely he will have recovered." He swung his gaze to meet me. "But you had not. You had just stopped. In some ways. Oh, you were older and wiser, I suppose. But you had not made any move on your own to reach out to life again. But for your wolf, I think it would have been even worse. As it was, you were living like a mouse in a wall, off the crumbs of affection that Starling tossed you. As thick-skinned as she is, even she could see it. She gave you Hap, and you took him in. But if she had not brought him to your doorstep and dumped him there, would you have sought out anyone to share your life? He leaned closer to me and said, "Even after you came back to Buckkeep in your old world, you held yourself apart from it. No matter what I did or offered, my Black, you couldn't even connect to a horse." I stood very still. His words stung, but they were also true. "Done is done," I said at last. "The best I can do now is to say, if that is what you came here to do, don't do it. It wasn't worth it." He sighed. "I'll admit I thought of it. I admit I longed for it. I will even tell you that this is not the first time I have visited Girl on a Dragon since we came here. I thought of offering her my memories. I know she would take them just as she took yours, but in a way, although I did not see this future, almost it seems as if it was meant to be. Fitz, what do you recall of her story?" I took a breath. "Verity told me that she was part of a coterie making a dragon. I recall her name. Salt. I discovered that the night I gave her my memories. But Salt could not give herself willingly to the dragon. She sought to remain a part of the coterie, and yet separate, to be only the girl of Girl on a Dragon. And with that she doomed them. Because she held back too much, they did not have enough life to take flight as a dragon. They nearly quickened, but then mired down in stone. Until you freed them."
"Until we freed them."
After a long time, he said.
"It is like an echo of a dream to me. Salt was the leader of the coterie, and so it was called Salt's Coterie. But when it came to the carving, the one willing to give heart to the dragon was Realder. So, when all believed that the dragon would be quickened, it was announced as Realder's dragon." He looked at me quietly. "You saw her, crowned with the rooster crown. A rare honor, and even rarer for a foreigner. But she had come a long way to seek her catalyst, and like me, she had taken on the role of performer, jester, minstrel, tumbler." He shook his head. "I had only that moment of being her, just that brief dream. When I stood upon the pillar, I was, as I am, a white prophet, and I stood high above the crowd and announced the flight of Realder's dragon to the people of this elderling town. But not without regrets, for I knew that my catalyst would do that day what he had always been destined to do. He would enter a dragon, so that years hence he could work a change."
He stopped and smiled a bittersweet smile, the first I had seen on his face in days. How it must have grieved her to see Realder's dragon mire and fail due to Salt's hesitation. She probably thought that she had failed too. But if Realder had not made a dragon, and if that dragon had not failed, and if we had not found them there, still in the quarry, what then, Fitz Chivalry Farseer?
You looked far back that day to see a white prophet clowning on top of a skill pillar. Did you see all that?
I blinked slowly. It was like awakening from a dream, or perhaps returning to one. His words seemed to wake memories I could not possibly hold.
"I will give Realder's dragon, the rooster crown. That was the price he named for me. The first time I flew with him, he said that he wished to wear forever the crown the White Prophet wore, on the day his beloved said farewell to him right before he entered this dragon."
"The price for what?" I asked him, but he did not answer. Instead, he looped the crown over one of his wrists, and then began his cautious climb up the dragon. It saddened me to see him move so stiffly and cautiously. Almost I could feel the tightness of the new skin that pulled across his back. But I did not offer him my hand. I think that would have made it worse for both of us. Once he stood behind her on the dragon's haunches, he balanced himself. Then, taking the crown in both hands, he settled the circle on her brow. For a moment, it remained as it was, silvery wood. And then, color flowed into it from the dragon. The crown gleamed gold. The rooster heads that ringed it shone red and their jeweled eyes winked. The feathers themselves took on the gloss of real feathers and lost all stiffness. to bow just as real cockerel plumes would have nodded. A deeper flush seemed to suffuse the girl's cheeks. She seemed to draw a breath. I was transfixed with amazement. And then her eyes opened, as green as her dragon's scales. She gave no look to me, but twisted in her seat to look up at the fool still standing on the dragon's haunches behind her. She reached back a hand to cup his jaw. Her eyes locked with his. He leaned closer to her, captured by her gaze. Then her hand moved to the back of his head, and she pulled his mouth down onto hers. She kissed him deeply. I had to witness the passion of what she shared with him, yet it did not seem like gratitude. And as she prolonged the kiss, I think the fool would have broken away if he could. He stiffened, and the muscles of his neck stood out. He never embraced her, but his hands went from wide open and forbidding to clenched fists, clutched against his chest. And still she kissed him, and I feared to see him either melt into her or turn to stone in her embrace. I feared what he gave, and feared more what she took from him. Had not he heard a word of what I had said to him? Why hadn't he heeded my warning? And then, as suddenly as she had stirred to life, she released him. As if he no longer mattered, she turned away from him and once more stretched her face up to the sunlight. It seemed to me that she sighed once, deeply, and then closed her eyes. Stillness crept over her. The gleaming rooster crown had become a part of Girl on a Dragon. But the fool, released from that unwelcome intimacy, was limp and falling. In a near swoon he toppled from the dragon's back, and I was barely able to catch him and keep him from tearing loose all his newly healed hurts. Even so he cried out as I closed my arms around him. I could feel him shuddering, like a man in an ague. He turned to me, his eyes blind, and cried out piteously,
"It is too much! You are too human, Fitz. I am not made for such as this. Take it from me. Take it, or I shall die of it."
"Take what?" I demanded. Breathlessly, he replied,
"Your pain. Your life."
I stood, frozen and uncomprehending, as he lifted his mouth to mine. I think he tried to be gentle. Nonetheless, it was more like a serpent's strike than a tender kiss, as his mouth fastened to mine and the venom of pain flowed. I think that if there had not been his love mixed with the anguish he gave back to me, I would have died of it, human or not. It was a searing, scalding kiss, a flow of memories, and once they began, I could not deny them. No man in the fullness of his years should have to experience afresh all the passion that a youngster is capable of embracing. Our hearts grow brittle as we age, mine near shattered in that onslaught. It was a storm of emotion. I had not forgotten my mother, never forgotten. I had banished her to a part of my heart and refused to open the door to it, but she was there, her long gold hair smelling of marigolds, and I remembered my grandmother, also of mountain stock. But my grandfather had been no more than a common guardsman, posted too long at Moon's Eye and taking on the mountain ways. All that I knew in a flash, and recalled how my mother had summoned me in from the pastures where, even at 5, I had a share of the shepherding. "Kepit! Kepit!" her clear voice would ring out, and I would run to her barefoot over wet grass. And Molly, how would I ever banish the smell and taste of her? Honey and herbs, and the way her laugh rang like chimes when I had chased down the beach after her, her red skirts whipping wildly around her bare calves as she ran, or the feel of her hair in my hands, the heavy strands of it tangling and snagging on the rough skin of my palms. Her eyes were dark, but they'd held the light of the candles when I'd looked down on them below me as I made love to her in her servant's room in the upper reaches of Buckkeep Castle. I had thought that light seen there would always belong only to me. And Burrick. He'd been father to me, in every way he could, and friend to me when I'd been tall enough to stand at his side. A part of me understood how he had fallen in love with Molly when he thought I was dead, but a part of me was outraged and hurt beyond common sense or rationality that he could have taken to wife the mother of my daughter. In ignorance and passion he had stolen from me both woman and child. Blow after blow rained on me. I was pounded iron on an anvil of memory. I languished again in Regal's dungeons. I smelled the rotting straw on the floor and felt the cold of the stone against my smashed mouth and pulped cheek as I lay there, trying to die so he could not hurt me any more. It was a sharp echo of the beating Galen had given me years before on the stone tower top we had called the Queen's Garden. He had assaulted me physically and with a skill, and to finish the task he had crippled my magic, putting it firmly in my mind that I had no ability and would do better to kill myself than live on in shame to my family. He had given me forever the memory of teetering on the brink of taking my own life. It was new. It all happened to me afresh, flaying my soul and leaving me bared to a salty wind. I came back to summer and the sun's slackening strength. The shadows were darker under the trees. I sprawled on the forest humus, my face hidden in my hands beyond tears. The fool sat next to me in the leaves and grass, patting my back as if I were an infant, and singing some gentle, silly song in his old tongue. Slowly it caught my attention, and my shuddering breaths calmed. When at last I was still, he spoke to me quietly. "It's all right now, Fitz. You're whole again. This time when we go back, you'll go all the way back to your old life, all of it." After a time, I found I could breathe deeply again. Gradually I got to my feet. I moved so cautiously that the fool came to take my arm, but it was not weakness but wonder that slowed my steps. I was like a man given back his sight. The edges of every leaf stood out when I glanced at it, and there the veins and a lacy heart where insects had fed. Birds called overhead and answered, and my wit of them was so keen that I could not focus on the soft questions the fool kept asking me. Light broke in streams through the canopy of leaves overhead, sending shafts of gold arrowing through the forest. Floating pollen sparked briefly in those beams. We came to the stream, and I knelt to drink its cold, sweet water. But as I bent over it, the rippling of the water over the stones suddenly captured me and drew me into the clear, darkling world beneath the moving water. Silt was layered in patterns over the smooth pebbles, and water plants moved gently in the current. A silver fingerling angled through the plants to disappear beneath a trapped brown leaf. I poked at it with a finger and had to laugh aloud at how he darted away from me. I looked up at the fool to see if he had also seen it, and found him looking down on me fondly but solemnly. He set his hand to my head as if he were a father blessing a child, and said, "If I think of all that befell me as a linked chain that brings me finally to this place with you kneeling by the water, alive and whole, then the price was not too high. To see you whole again heals me." He was right. I was whole again. We did not leave the forest plaza that evening. Instead, I built a new fire and stared into it for most of the night. As if I was sorting scrolls or storing herbs for Chade, I went through all the years since I had given half my life away and reordered my experience of them. Half-passions. Relationships in which I had invested nothing and received it in return. Retreats and evasions. Withdrawal. The fool lay between the fire and me, pretending to sleep. I knew he kept vigil with me. Towards dawn, he asked me, "Did I do you a wrong?" "No," I said quietly. "I did myself a wrong long ago. You've put me on the path to righting it. I did not know how I would do it, but I knew I would." In the morning I scattered the ashes of our fire on the plaza. We left the elderling tent billowing in the wind and fled a promised summer squall. We shared out my winter clothing between us, and then, his fingers pressed to my wrist and skill-linked, we entered the pillar. We stepped out into the pillar room of the pale woman's ice castle. The fool gasped and went to his knees after two staggering steps into the room. The trip through the pillar did not affect me as badly, though I knew a moment's vertigo. Almost immediately the chill of the place seized me. I helped the fool to his feet. He stared around himself in wonder, hugging himself against the cold. I gave him some time to recover, and time to explore the frost-rimmed window panes, the snowy view, and the skill pillar that dominated the room, and then told him quietly, "Come on." We went down the stairs and halted again in the map room. He looked down at the world portrayed there. His long fingers wandered over the rippling sea and then returned to hover over Buck. Without touching them, he indicated the four jewels set near Buckkeep.
These gems, they indicate skill pillars.
I think so, I replied, and those would be the witness stones. He touched, a wistful caress, the coast of a land far to the south and east of Buckkeep. No gem winked there. He shook his head.
No one who knew me lives there any more. Silly even to think of it.
It's never silly to think of going home, I assured him. If I asked Catrican, she...
No,
he said quietly.
It was but a passing fancy, Fitz. I cannot go back there.
When he had finished gazing at the map, we went down the stairs, deeper into the pale blue light of the labyrinth. I felt as if we descended back into old nightmare. As we went, I saw his trepidation grow. He grew paler, not just from the cold. The half-healed bruises on his face stood out like shadows of the pale woman's power over us. I tried to stay to the stone passages and find some egress from there, without success. As we wandered from room to room, the beauty of the place touched me, even as I worried about the fool's growing silence and weariness. Perhaps we had misjudged, and he was not yet ready to confront the place where he had been so tormented. Many of the chambers on this stone level seemed untouched by the vandalism and degradation I had seen elsewhere in the ice fortress. Themes of forest and flowers or fish and birds were lovingly chiselled into the stone lintels and were echoed in the friezes within the chambers. The friezes seemed exotic and foreign, the colours either too pastel or too smoky for my six duchies' taste. The figures of the humans were elongated, with fancifully coloured eyes and strange markings on their faces. They called to mind Selden, the Bingtown trader, with his unnatural growth and scaled face. I said as much to the fool, and he nodded. Sometime later, as we walked down yet another stone passageway, he asked me, "Have you ever seen a white rose that has grown for years in proximity to a red?" "Probably," I said, thinking of the gardens of Buckkeep. "Why?" His mouth quirked to one side. "I think you have looked at them without truly seeing them. After years of such closeness, there is an exchange. It shows most plainly in the white roses, for they may take on a rosy blush, or exhibit faint tendrils of red in what used to be snowy white blossoms. It happens because there has been an exchange of the very stuff of their beings." I gave him a curious look, wondering if his mind was wandering and I should be concerned. He shook his head at me.
"Be patient. Let me explain. Dragons and humans can live side by side. But when they do so for a long period, they influence one another. Elderlings show the effect of having been exposed to dragons for generations."
He shook his head, a bit sadly, and added,
"It is not always a graceful transformation. Sometimes there is too much exposure, and the children do not survive much past birth or suffer a shortened lifespan. For a few, life may be extended at the expense of fertility. The elderlings were a long-lived race, but they were not fecund. Children were rare and treasured."
"And we are responsible for bringing dragons back into the world, so they may wreak this change upon us again?" I asked him.
"Yes, we are."
He seemed quite calm about it.
"Humanity will learn the cost of living in proximity to dragons. Some will pay it gladly. Elderlings will return."
We walked for a time in silence, and another question came to me. "But what of dragons? Do they take no effect from their exposure to us?" He was silent for a longer time. Then he said,
"I suspect they do. But they find it shameful and banish such beings. You have been to Others Island."
That boggled my thoughts. I could think of nothing to say. Again we came to a junction of corridors, one of ice and two of stone. I chose one of the stone ones at random. As we paced along it, I tried to reconcile the fool's notion of elderlings with what I had experienced of them. "I thought elderlings were close to gods," I said at last. "Far loftier than humans in both spirit and mind. So they have seemed when I've encountered them, fool." He gave me a quizzical look.
"In the skill current, bodiless beings of great power of mind."
He threw up his head suddenly, and I halted beside him, listening. He turned to look at me, his eyes huge. My hand went to my sword. For a time we stood frozen. I heard nothing.
"It's all right," I told him.
Air moves in these old passages. It sounds like someone whispering in the distance. He nodded, but it took several minutes for his breath to slow. Then he said, "I suspect that the skill is what remains to you from an older time, that it is the trailing end of a talent that developed between dragons and humans as a way to communicate. I do not understand what you speak of when you talk of the skill current, but perhaps the ability can allow one to transcend the need for a physical body. You have already shown me that it is a far more powerful magic than I ever suspected. Perhaps it was a result of living alongside the dragons, and perhaps it lingered. So that even after dragons were gone, the descendants of the elderlings kept that ability and passed it down to their children. Some inherited little of it. In others..." He gave me a sideways glance. "The elderling blood ran stronger." When I was silent for a time, he asked almost mockingly, "You can't quite admit it aloud, can you? Not even to me?" "I think you are wrong. Would not I know such things if they were true? Would not I feel them? You seem to be saying that I am descended somehow from the elderlings, and that would mean that, in a sense, I am part dragon myself?" He gave a snort of laughter. It was so welcome a sound from him that I treasured it, even at my expense.
"Only you would put it that way, Fitz. No, not that you are part dragon, but rather that somewhere the stuff of dragons entered your family line. Some ancestor of yours may have breathed the dragon's breath, as the old tales say, and it has come down to you."
We walked on, our feet scuffing on stone. The passages echoed oddly, and several times the fool glanced back over his shoulder. "Like a long-tailed kitten born from a long line of stump tails?" I asked him.
"I suppose you could think of it that way."
I nodded slowly to myself. That would account for the skill cropping up in odd places, even in the Out-Islanders, it would seem.
"What's this?"
His eyes had always been sharper than mine. His long fingers touched a mark scratched on the wall. Incredulous, I stepped closer to peer at it. It was one of mine. "It's the way home," I told him.
Chapter 31 Dragon's Head. And dark Oetar, mother to them all, lifted her eyes and shook her head. "It cannot be," she said with grave resolve. "We are not bound by what mere men have said. My eldest must remain here to reign after me. Woman to woman is our power past. You would take Arnarcheska to be your queen. Of all our treasure, she would be the last that we would forfeit, no matter what your deed. Show me, in fact, how you have fulfilled the letter of your promise. In blood you wrote your vow that you'd do as she had willed. O Farseer Prince, recall now the boast that you did say. On these hearthstones of our mother's house, Icefire's head you'd lay. The dragon's head." Cockle Longspur. We followed my marks backward through the elderling maze, and emerged eventually from the crack in the icy wall into a bright day. The wind was brisk, and blowing ice crystals filled the air, peppering our skins and making the steep path treacherous underfoot. The clear light of true day made my eyes tear. The fool went before me down the steep path. Here, exposed to the wind and cold, his weakness showed plain, and I muttered at my own stupidity. This had overtaxed him. The second time he slipped, I took a firm grip on the back of his collar and kept him upright on his feet until we reached the black man's door. "Knock," I told him, but when he only stared back at me, bleary-eyed with exhaustion, I reached past him to thud my fist against the wood. The door was opened so swiftly that I had to believe he had been waiting for us. Even then the fool stood frozen, staring at the smiling black man who confronted us. "He's cold and very weary," I excused him, and then thrust him into the room in front of me. Once inside, I pushed the door firmly shut behind us, and then turned back gratefully to the cozy room. I blinked, letting my eyes adjust to the dimness after the brightness of full daylight. I saw the small hearth fire first, and then I found the black man staring at the fool in mutual incredulity.
"He was dead," the black man told me firmly. "He died."
His eyes were very wide. Yes, he was. I confirmed it for him. But I am the catalyst. I changed things. And then Thick sprang up from the hearth and grasped me in a short-limbed hug. He danced like a little bear as he shouted,
"You're back! You're back! I thought you would never come back! Chade said the ship is coming, and I said, but he's not here, and I won't get on a ship. Then he said, it's coming anyway, and it did, but no one was there, and it went back, because I said, no, I am not walking back all alone, and I don't want to get on a ship anyway."
He halted his dance, and then told me with a satisfied grin,
"Either you are dead, or Chade is so angry at you that you'll wish you were." That was what he said. Dutiful. "Oh, and the dragon head. I forgot to tell the dragon head part. Nettle did it. She sent the dragon head to the mother's house, and it was a big surprise for everyone. Except me. She told me she could do it. Could talk to Tintaglia and make her sorry if she didn't. So she did. And everything is good again now."
The last he said so confidently that it was difficult to look down into the cheerful, round-eyed face and say, "I don't think I understood half of what you just told me, and I think I've been away longer than I thought, but I'm glad to be back." I extricated myself from his hug. A strange silence had fallen in the other half of the room. The black man and the fool regarded one another, not with animosity, but disbelief. Looking at the two of them together, I could see a kinship, but it was one of ancient lineage rather than a close family resemblance. The black man was the first to speak.
"Welcome," he said faintly.
"I never saw you," the fool said wonderingly. "In all the futures I glimpsed, in all that might be, I never saw you."
He abruptly began to tremble, and I knew he was at the end of his strength. The black man seemed to sense this also, for he pushed a cushion closer to the fire and motioned hastily that the fool should be seated. The fool more collapsed than sat down. I took my cloak from around him, telling him, "The warmth will reach you faster if you let it in."
"I don't think I'm that cold," he said faintly. "I'm just... I'm outside my time, Fitz. I'm a fish in the air or a bird beneath the sea. I'm past my life, and I grope forward through each day, wondering what I am meant to do with myself. It's hard. It's very hard for me."
His voice dwindled as he said the words. He looked up at the black man as if begging for help. His head wavered on his neck. I did not know what to say to him. Did he resent that I had sought more life for him? It hurt to think so, but I held my tongue. I watched the black man grope for words.
"This I can teach."
The black man's voice slowly faded away. A smile slow as sunrise came to his face. He cocked his head at the fool and said something in another tongue. The fool opened to him as a flower turns to light. A tremulous smile lit his face, and he replied hesitantly in the same language. The black man whooped aloud in delight to hear him. He gestured at himself and said something rapidly, and then, as if remembering his manners, took up the kettle and a cup, and with a graceful flourish poured tea for the fool and set it before him. The fool thanked him extravagantly. Their language seemed to take many words to say simple things. Not one syllable of it resembled any tongue I'd ever heard before. The fool's voice grew fainter. He took a breath and then finished what he was saying. I felt an adolescent pang of exclusion. Almost as if the fool sensed it, he turned slowly to me. He pushed his hair back from his face with fingers that shook.
"I have not heard the language of my childhood since, well, since I left home. It is like balm to hear it again."
Chade and Dutiful must have known through Thick that I had returned, for I felt then such a battering against my skill walls as might have been a siege. I decided reluctantly that it was time to let them in. I took the cup of tea the black man had just poured for me, and sat down by his fire, and then, seeing the fool well occupied with our host, I surrendered and lowered my skill walls. Chade's blast of fury, fear, and frustration preceded all thought, shaking and cuffing me, as if I were an errant serving boy. When he was finished, I think it annoyed him even more that I laughed at his onslaught, even as my reaction cheered Dutiful.
"Not much can be wrong with you if you can laugh like that,"
I've never felt such a carelessness of spirit from you. I caught the boy's sense of amazement and wonder. An instant later, Chade echoed it. What has come over you? Are you drunk? No. I am whole and well healed. And so is the fool. But my tale will keep. Does all go well with you? Has our prince well and truly won his bride? Thick has told me a wild bit of tale about a dragon's head on the mother's house hearth. Is it true? Who killed Icefire? No one killed the dragon. It was just his head he placed there, but yes, it seems to be done and settled. Chade replied with grim satisfaction. Now that we know you are safe, we can sail tomorrow. That is, if Dutiful can find the courage to tell his bride she must come home with him. I but allow her time to be sure it is her will that she follows in this, Dutiful replied sternly. I do not understand. Would someone start at the beginning and tell the tale? And then it was that I heard in full from both Chade and Dutiful, with excited asides from Thick, of how Nettle had bedeviled and nagged Tintaglia, troubling her dreams in her waking hours, importuning her to pay back the puny humans who had suffered so much, so that Icefire could fly free. Tintaglia, in her turn, had driven Icefire, much as a pigeon drives his mate to the nest, back to Zillig, where the dragons presented themselves to the Hetgerd still convened there. And then on to Mail Island and Weaslington. There the dragons had landed before Eliania's mother's house. I gathered that there had been some structural damage in the process, but nonetheless the immense ice fire had forced his way into the mother's house, where he ungraciously placed his head, very briefly, upon the hearthstones, so that Dutiful's promise to Eliania might be completely carried out. I thought that Eliania had professed herself satisfied that Dutiful had fulfilled his promise and proven himself worthy of her when he aided in the rescue of her mother and sister. I was a bit confused as to why all this had been necessary. Oh, she has shown herself well satisfied for some days now, Chade replied acidly, and I suspected that perhaps Dutiful's virtue had not been proof against the girl's importuning. It is her mother who has proven difficult, much to Piotr's woe. Oetta told us, before we were even docked in Zillig, that she did not regard any agreement that men had brokered concerning her daughter as binding. She finds it unthinkable that Eliania would leave her home, even to be queen of all the 6 duchies. She has raised 1,000 faults with the arrangement, saying that as she herself was still alive, and therefore the true Narcheska, all of this was agreed to without the proper consent. She objects to the idea of Lestra inheriting the title of Narcheska. She finds the girl unfit to rule after her, and she is horrified at the thought that Eliania's and Dutiful's children would remain in the 6 duchies. Except for our sons, Dutiful interjected. True, Chade conceded. She has been more than willing to allow Dutiful and Eliania to, that is, to become, to have... He could not find a delicate way to verbalize the thought. Dutiful was more prosaic. Her mother was willing to allow me to share Eliania's bed. She seemed affronted that anyone might think to thwart her daughter in who she wishes to bed, and the Narcheska Oeta had offered that any male children so conceived would be given to the 6 duchies, at the age of 7. There was a mutual silence as they allowed me to digest that idea. It was untenable. None of his dukes would accept an heir thus created. And now? Now that Icefire has fulfilled completely Eliania's challenge to Dutiful? Narcheska Oeta was impressed. It is hard not to be impressed when a creature of that size lumbers through your home and places his head on your hearthstones, especially when some of the framework of your door is still around his neck. I could easily excuse Dutiful's youthful satisfaction at this vindication. I think her objections are at an end, and even if she still has reservations, there were enough members of the Hetgerd here to witness it that they will not stand. They now see it as honour that Eliania will come to my hearth, to found a new mother's house, is how they phrase it. As if she were conquering all the 6 duchies by becoming Dutiful's queen, Chade complained. Yet I could hear the relief in his voice. I foresaw there would be difficulties in future days as the customs of her land clashed with ours. If she bore a son first, would her relatives be scandalized to see him inherit before her daughters? I set the thought from my mind. There would be enough time to worry about that when it happened. And how was that brought about? Ask Thick. He and Nettle seem to have concocted that. The smile faded from my face. I had to know. Does Nettle know about Burric's death? Yes. Chade's reply was short and grim. I would not wish such news to be withheld from me," Dutiful pointed out severely. I knew he was justifying his action to Chade as much as to me. And so I did as I thought best. Besides, my mother deserved that news as well, that she can see to the needs of the family of the man who served us so well and so long. Besides, when I stand before my cousin in the flesh, I do not wish to do so with a bag of dirty secrets behind my back. That seemed harsh, and I sensed that I trod on the edges of a quarrel between Dutiful and Chade. It did not seem a good time to advance my own opinion. Moreover, it was too late to change what had been done. So I tried to change the subject instead. So the wedding will now proceed with no further objections. Now it can. Dutiful had insisted we remain here until we heard from you, or until we decided you were dead, and sent a rescue party back for Thick. Not that he was fond of the idea of being rescued and brought home, but now that you are there, we shall send a boat for both of you immediately. As soon as you arrive here, we can proceed home.
No boats,
Thick insisted. The prince ignored him. Our wait for Fitz has not been wasted time, Dutiful contradicted Chade. It would not have been appropriate to immediately snatch the Narcheska from her family. Eliania has been too long separated from her mother and sister. I have enjoyed seeing them together. And when she looks from her sister to me, Fitz, she thinks I am a hero. The Out-Islander bards are making songs of this. Very long songs, Chade added. We've had to listen to them smiling nearly every night. We simmered into satisfied silence. My prince had won his bride. There would be peace between the six duchies and the Out-Islands. Then Dutiful added solemnly, And I was glad that you were allowed some time to deal with your loss. I am sorry, Fitz. Chade asked quietly, You were able to recover the fool's body? It was my moment for triumph. I recovered the fool.
I thought he was dead.
Dutiful's gravity dissolved in amazement. So did I replied, and abruptly decided to leave that as my full explanation. It was easy enough to divert them from any more questions regarding the fool. I simply added, I am sorry to have missed the ship you sent for us, but you need not bother with another. Thick and I have an easier way back to Buckkeep, one that does not require him to set foot on a deck again. Their astonishment at my revelation of the working skill pillar could not match Thick's delight at the news he could go home without sailing. He suddenly clutched me about the middle, tugged me to my feet, and capered so wildly about me that I could not hold the focus necessary to skill. I seized him by his shoulders, and braced my feet to stop our dance, and then looked up to find the black man regarding us with alarmed amusement. The fool looked too tired to show any surprise. He just realized that we could go home through the skill pillars, I explained to them. Thick hates boats, and he is delighted to know that our journey may be a matter of moments instead of days. The black man looked at me without comprehension. Then the fool said something to him in his own tongue, and the man made a long ah of understanding and nodded sagely. The fool's explanation seemed to bring to his mind some other incident, for the black man launched into a long monologue intended for the fool. Thick skidded to a sudden halt and cocked his head as if listening.
Skill scrolls. Chade says, bring the skill scrolls.
He paused, frowning as he paid attention to Chade's skilling.
But not yet. Don't go home yet. Not until he has a good way to explain it. But soon. Nettle is getting tired of all the messages. You could do it better.
I had given Chade much to think about, and to my relief he excused himself from our skilling to do just that. Dutiful attempted to explain to me how Nettle had persuaded Icefire to present his head to the Narcheska, but Thick was too excited to permit our conversation, and I sensed restlessness from the prince that told me that he had better ways to pass his time than lingering with me. I sent him off with a stern warning to be circumspect, which I am sure he ignored. I came back to full awareness to find the